had shifted, and she was struggling to navigate back to normal. She began thinking about her life as two parallel tracks. The one she was living, with her late-night lab work and the demands of decks and fish taking up her time. And the life she'd had just a couple weeks ago. Dinners with Liz, an uncomplicated window of time that had felt lighter and brighter than she'd ever imagined. And now, as she wove her way through the crowds dressed in blue and gold, up the hill that led to Memorial Stadium, her mind was fuzzy, her eyes gritty. She waited in line at the gate, her eyes trained on the security guards asking everyone to open their purses and bags for inspection. She pressed her arm against her side, feeling the outline of the package of pills, safely tucked into an inner pocket of her coat. Eva hadn't contacted any of her clients to let them know she was back to work. She would make the drugs for Fish, but as far as her clients were concerned, she was still on hiatus and would remain so indefinitely. Her singular goal was to gather as much information about Fish and the way his organization was structured as she could, not make money she didn't really need. When she reached the front of the line, she opened her purse and watched the guard's eyes scan the contents. A wallet, sunglasses, and small voice recorder. And held her breath as she always did, waiting for someone to finally see through her act, to finally see her for what she really was. But that wasn't going to happen today. As she passed through the entrance and into the stadium, the field spread out below her, each end zone painted with a yellow California set against a dark blue background. The trademark script Cal centered on the 50-yard line. Eva ignored the people in the seats around her, instead staring across the field as the marching band played and students filled the section next to it, feeling more isolated and alone than she'd felt in years. As an undergrad, Eva had only been to one game, and the memory of it haunted her every time she returned. "Meet me in the North Tunnel afterward," Wade had said. She'd been shocked to see the number of people lingering there, waiting for players, hangers-on, followers, sorority girls flipping their hair and checking their lip gloss. She'd hung back watching, as she always did, from the perimeter. When he came out, his eyes scanned the crowd and landed on her, as if she glowed. He passed through the crowd of people and claimed her, putting his arm around her and leading her away, the smell of his soap mixing with the redwood trees that surrounded the stadium. She knew then that she was lost, that Wade Roberts had chosen her, and she was bound to follow whether she wanted to or not. She'd met him in the chemistry lab she was TAing. At first, she'd assumed he was just another jock trying to flirt his way to a better grade. But every time Wade had looked at her, she felt an electric zing pass through her. Early in the semester, she'd been walking them through some basic chemical reactions when Wade had said, "Why are we doing this? When are we ever going to need to know what substances react with calcium chloride?" She should have redirected him back to the task, but Eva knew she needed to be someone unexpected if she hoped to hold his attention. "Do you like candy?" she'd asked him. And then she'd shown them all how to make strawberry-flavored crystals, a simple procedure that anyone could find on the internet if they wanted to. That was how it started, a pin in the map that marked the beginning of a journey she never wanted to take. Wade had begun pressuring her to try making drugs shortly after they started dating. At first, she didn't want to. But what he was asking was so simple, she figured she'd do it once and get him off her back. Science had always been where she felt the safest, among the laws of physics and chemistry. Unlike life, which could dump you at a group home at the age of two with no warning or second chances, chemistry was predictable, its actions absolute. Wade was the person everyone wanted to be close to, and he wanted to be close to her. And so, when he asked her to do it again, she did, and then again after that. The stadium was filling up. Eva checked her watch and reached into her purse to activate the voice recorder. Across the field, the marching band drums pounded a rhythm, the same one from that day so many years ago. The people around her pressed closer, making her feel smothered, and she tried to shrink down inside herself, to just hang on, wait, to do her job and be ready. "Been here long?" Dex asked, sliding into the seat next to her. "Maybe 5 minutes." Her eyes traveled up the hill where the cannon that fired after every touchdown poked through the trees on its platform, a white California banner fluttering in the wind. Tight wad hill, open to anyone willing to hike up there and sit in the dirt. Fucking Berkeley. "God, I hate this place," she said.
"Then give me what you've got and let's get out of here."
He twisted around, looking into the crowd behind them, and then faced forward again, his knee bouncing a jittery rhythm. Eva shook her head. "Not a chance. We do this my way." She knew that just because Dex said Castro was gone, it didn't mean he wasn't still out there, watching her, waiting for her to make a mistake.
"You really don't need to worry.
Your lack of detail does not inspire confidence," Eva said. She pulled her purse from underneath her seat and inspected the bottom of it, wiping dead leaves and an old gum wrapper off of it before placing it next to her armrest. "You need to give me specifics. Who was following me, why, and how it is they're gone now." Dex slouched down in his seat, his gaze leaping from one thing to another, never landing, never still. "Fine," he said. "It was a joint task force, DEA and locals, looking to grab fish, which they've been trying to do for years. The whole thing got disbanded 2 weeks ago."
"How is it possible fish can call off a joint task force?" she pressed.
Dex squinted across the field where the band launched into a version of Funky Cold Medina. Finally, he said,
"It costs a lot of money to run surveillance, and you weren't giving them anything. They can't keep watching you forever. Higher-ups pulled the money, and with no evidence pointing anywhere, Fish's friends inside the department began rumbling about better uses of resources and bitching about the budget. They had no choice but to fold."
"Listen to yourself," she said. "Federal agents, joint task forces, and you're telling me not to worry?
I'm telling you this topic is closed. You need to drop it."
She studied his profile, softer around the contours of his jaw, laugh lines framing his eyes and mouth. She'd known Dex for 12 years, and something was off about him today. Just then, the cannon fired as the Cal team burst out of the north tunnel, and next to her, Dex nearly leaped out of his seat. He covered it by rising along with the rest of the crowd as the band launched into the fight song. But Eva wasn't fooled. "Are you okay?" she asked.
"Yeah,"
he said, shoving his hands in his pockets as they sat again and the first quarter started.
"Just a little rattled."
"You just finished telling me all was well. What the hell, Dex?"
He shook his head. "It's fine. Just, Fish is looking into that guy I told you about. My friend who referred Brittany."
"Are you in danger?"
Dex gave a hollow laugh and looked at her, his eyes sad.
"When am I not?"
At halftime, they headed back into the mezzanine. As people made their way toward the bathrooms or the concession stands, Eva led Dex toward the doors, labeled Stadium Club. She handed her badge to the guard at the door, who scanned it and waved them through. The noise of the stadium faded as she led Dex up a set of stairs and into a large room that overlooked the campus, all the way to the San Francisco Bay and the Golden Gate Bridge in the far distance.
"I'll get drinks," Dex said, leaving Eva to stare out the window and think about another time,
an office with an almost identical view, the ghost of Wade Roberts still following her. It had been the nicest office Eva had ever seen in all her years at Berkeley. Set high on the hill at the top of campus, its window offered sweeping views all the way to the Golden Gate and beyond. In a corner, a clock ticked, measuring Eva's fate in seconds. The dean flipped through her file, and she'd glanced at the door again, wondering when Wade would show up and deliver the pardon he promised.
"I see you're a scholarship student."
The dean looked up, waiting for her to confirm. She stared at his nose, a sharp beak that propped up a pair of bifocals, and said nothing. He resumed his reading.
"You came from St. Joe's in the city?"
The first glimmer of sympathy. She could almost time its arrival. When people found out she grew up in a group home, they either took a step back or a step forward. But it almost always changed how they viewed her. She'd shrugged and looked at the door again. "It's all in the file." Her tone was more abrupt than she'd intended, and she wished she could reel her words back in and start over. Tell him how attached she'd grown to her life as a student, that Berkeley was a place where potential seemed to shine down and touch her shoulders. But Eva had never been able to offer honesty like that. So she said nothing and waited for the rest to happen.
"It seems foolish to throw it all away by making drugs in the chemistry lab," he'd said.
Eva was saved from responding when the door swung open and the dean's assistant ushered Wade in. The breath Eva had been holding released. Wade had promised her he would tell the dean that making the drugs had been his idea and would assume all of the blame. As the quarterback of the football team, he'd get a slap on the wrist, maybe a one-game suspension, but nothing that would ruin his career. But her relief quickly vanished as Wade was followed by Coach Garrison. Eva had only seen his picture in the paper, or once as a tiny pacing ant on the sidelines of the only football game she'd ever been to, at Wade's behest.
"I want my girlfriend to watch me play."
It had been the word girlfriend that had done it. Eva had never been anything to anyone. Not daughter, not friend, certainly never girlfriend. She had felt foolish that the betrayal struck her so deeply, that she'd allowed herself to believe Wade might be different.
"All they had was white," Deck said, handing her a small plastic cup of wine.
Eva tore her eyes away from the view and refocused on the present. She'd believed she'd risen from the ashes, making a life for herself. But it had all been an illusion, a delusion. Nothing had changed at all.
Dex had stepped into the space Wade had vacated, and things continued as they'd begun, only on a much larger scale.
Dex drank from his cup and grimaced.
"How much do you pay every year for the privilege of drinking shitty wine?" he asked.
The last thing Eva needed was a recording filled with musings about bad wine. "Sometimes I wonder whether I've ever encountered fish and not known it. Like, maybe he's one of those high-rolling donors over there." She pointed to a group of older men, clustered near a trophy case, clad in dark blue and gold. "It makes sense, really, for him to hide in plain sight like that." Dex stared at her over the top of his plastic cup, and she continued. "You know him. What's he like?" Dex shrugged.
"A regular guy, I guess. Nothing special. Scary as fuck if you make him mad."
A shiver passed through him, and he turned to look at Eva, his expression sad.
"Don't start asking questions now."
Eva took a sip of her wine, the sharp tang biting the back of her throat. "Don't worry. I know you can't tell me anything. But I've been thinking about what happens after I give you the pills. I never considered until now whether any of it could somehow be traced back to me. They can do some crazy shit with forensics."
"It doesn't stay local, if that's what you're worried about."
"I guess my worry hinges on what you consider local. Sacramento, Los Angeles, farther?" Dex took another sip of wine before dumping the rest into a nearby trash can.
"Let's finish this and get out of here."
They walked down a small side hallway toward a restroom with a gender-neutral icon on the door, where they fell in line behind a mother and small child. An older man exited and the mother and child entered, locking the door behind them. A server passed them in the hallway and said, "If you guys want, there are bigger bathrooms around the corner. No wait." Dex and Eva smiled and assured her they were fine. After another 5 minutes and some muffled crying behind the closed door, it was finally her turn. She locked the door and checked the recorder in her purse, frustrated Dex hadn't told her more. She leaned against the wall, the cool tile seeping through her shirt sleeve, trying to figure out what she could ask, what she could do, to get Dex to tell her something more specific, where they sent the drugs and who bought them, details about fish she could trade. Finally, she flushed the toilet, only pulling out the brightly wrapped package of pills after she'd washed and dried her hands. She placed it on top of the towel dispenser and exited,
letting Dex slip in after her. When he came out, he patted his coat and said, "Hope you don't mind, but I'd rather not stick around for the second half."
"I get it," she said. They made their way out of the club and back down the stairs, exiting the stadium.
They paused outside. "Look," he said, "we're both a little wound up, and you're right to want to be cautious."
He gestured toward the stadium behind them, where the game had resumed.
"We'll do this your way until we're both comfortable again."
She looked at him, his expression softer now that he'd gotten what he wanted from her. He was both comrade and captor, protector and prison guard. Regardless of how he behaved, Dex was not her friend. She had to remind herself he wasn't worried about her comfort. He was worried about himself. She gave him a grateful smile and said, "Thanks, Dex." As long as he believed he was handling her, he wouldn't notice how she was handling him. Later that night, instead of working, Eva sat in front of her computer staring at a blank search field. Being at the stadium today, remembering how it felt to sit there alone, with no one to fight for her, to say, "Eva is a good person, she deserves a second chance," made her wonder if a second chance would have even been possible. Liz's words floated back to her. "Information is power." Liz had poked through the boundaries she'd constructed for herself, and she wasn't sure if this would help resurrect them or destroy them completely. Eva tried to prepare herself for the most painful outcome. Her mother recovered, living a happy life with a family and friends, and entered her mother's full name into the search field, the only light in the room, the glowing of the screen, illuminating her face. Outside, a car glided by, quiet tires humming on the pavement. Then silence filled with the relentless chirp of crickets. She pressed return. A long list of hits popped up. Rachel Ann James on Facebook, images, Twitter, a Rachel Ann James at a college in Nebraska. She scrolled down and clicked on a free People Finder link, which brought up 18 potential matches. But none of the ages matched. Her mother would be in her early 50s, and these people were either too young or too old. Her body vibrated with anxiety, more than her most stressful drug deals, and she was tempted to stop, to close her computer, get back to work, and forget about all of it. But she navigated back to a new search and entered Rachel Ann James Obituary, California. This time, it was the first link in her results. It was a short paragraph from a local paper in Richmond, just a few miles north of Berkeley. No details were given about how she'd died, just the year and her age, 27. Rachel is survived by her parents, Nancy and Irvin James of Richmond, California, and brother Maxwell, 35. No mention of her, the granddaughter they didn't want. Eva stared at the screen, listening to the blood pump in her ears. Eva had been 8. She tried to match up the edges of the childhood she remembered with this new information, her time with Carmen and Mark, the return to the convent, when the nuns had reached out to her family again. Somewhere in there, her mother had died. And yet, her grandparents, Nancy and Irvin, finally freed from the nightmare of having an addict daughter, had still said no. She thought about printing the obituary, taking it downstairs and knocking on Liz's door, asking her how any of this gave her power. As far as she was concerned, it felt like 1,000 tiny cuts piercing her skin, a pain with no center, just a radiating fire that consumed her. But instead, she cleared her search and closed her computer, settling herself into the darkness, and got to work fitting this new rejection, this new heartbreak, alongside all the rest.
Claire, Saturday, February 26th. That Rory lied about his last weekend with Maggie is interesting, but not incriminating in a legal sense. Of course, he would make himself look sympathetic when recounting the story to me, his new girlfriend. and I can't begin to guess why Maggie might have changed her mind and gone anyways. But Maggie's reference to a scary argument chills me, because I know what Rory's temper looks like, how easily she could have ended up at the bottom of that staircase. But the note doesn't prove anything other than they fought, which was widely reported at the time. What nags at me is how Charlie Flanagan is connected to that weekend in 1992. That's the key to figuring out everything. Perhaps he was the one to organize the payoffs Aunt Mary mentioned, illegally skimming them from the foundation's account. A quick check of the time tells me I have just a half hour until I'm supposed to meet Kelly, so I go into the kitchen and grab a Diet Coke from the fridge and take a sip, staring out the back window. As I wait for the caffeine to hit my bloodstream, I imagine Charlie releasing whatever he has to the media. Huge exposés in The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, The New York Times, stripping Rory of all his power. I know it's a leap, but the fantasy still energizes me. I set the can on the counter and head upstairs in search of a pair of black pants and a white top. When I arrive at the coffee shop, Kelly is already there, waiting in her car, and I open the door and slide in. "Ready?" Kelly asks. "Let's do it." Kelly's phone rings as we hit the end of the block. "Jacinta," she says into the phone. "I'm on my way to work." She listens for a moment and then curses. "Okay, I'll be there in 5 minutes." She hangs up and turns the car around. "Sorry," she says. "My daughter Jacinta has been working on this project for her art history class, and she left the poster supplies in my trunk." "I don't mind," I tell her. Normally, I'd leave her to sweat it out, but she's working with a partner, and I don't want to punish her for Jacinta's carelessness. She sighs. "This project has been a pain in the ass from day one."
"What is it?"
"Compare and contrast two 20th century artists. Deliver an oral presentation with visuals." She rolls her eyes. "Berkeley takes its arts education very seriously."
"How old is your daughter?"
Kelly can't be much older than her late 20s.
12.
She glances at me, catching my surprised expression. "I had her when I was only 17.
"That must have been hard."
Kelly shrugs.
"My mother nearly killed me when she found out I was pregnant. But then it was buckle down to business."
We stop at a red light, and she glances at me.
"My mom is my rock. I couldn't work or go to school without her. And she and Jacinta are tight. Where I get attitude and eye rolling, my mother gets giggles and secrets."
"You must be busy working two jobs and going to school," I say. Kelly smiles as the light turns green.
"I suppose, but I've always worked, so I'm used to it. I have the early morning shift at the coffee shop, take classes during the day, and do catering events for Tom at nights and on the weekends. I'm saving money so Jacinta and I can get our own place. Right now, we live with my mother, and it's crowded."
I bite my lip, wishing I could tell her not to be in such a hurry to leave. Kelly's house is in a neighborhood of small one-story houses so similar to my mother's in Pennsylvania. I could squint my eyes and believe I was back home again. When we pull into the driveway, she turns to me and says,
"Come in and meet my family."
I hesitate, knowing I should stay in the car. There's a difference between being one of at least 20 black and white clad servers at an event and shimmying up to Kelly's family with a name and a handshake. But it would be strange if I refused. And I'm overwhelmed by how much I want to go inside. After so many days of being alone, I want to sit in someone's kitchen and talk about art.
"I know a bit about art history," I finally say. "Maybe I could help."
"We can use all the help we can get," Kelly says. It's exactly as I imagined it would be. The living room is spare, just a couch, a reclining chair, and a television. Through an open doorway is a small kitchen and eating area where two girls sit, hunched over the table. Beyond the living room is a short hallway that probably leads to a couple small bedrooms and a bathroom. My mother's house had the same feel to it, frayed and scarred around the edges, but polished to a high shine. I can imagine the three of them here in the evenings, each of them in her favorite spot. Kelly's mother in the armchair, Kelly and Jacinta on either end of the couch, their legs in a tangle, the way Violet and I used to watch TV. An older woman stands at the counter chopping vegetables, while on the stove pots simmer, the air thick with the smell of rosemary and sage. One of the girls looks up as we enter. "Sorry, Mom," she says. Kelly leads me into the kitchen and says, "Let's practice some manners, Jacinta. This is Eva." "Nice to meet you," I say. Jacinta smiles, and I can see Kelly in the set of her brown eyes and the sharp structure of her cheekbones. "Nice to meet you, too." "And her friend, Mel?" The other girl raises her hand in a half wave, then turns to Kelly and says, "Thanks for coming back, Kelly." Kelly squeezes her shoulder and says, "Only for you, Mel." The older woman chimes in from the counter. "I'm sorry I didn't check in with her before you left." She shoots a look at Jacinta. "She told me she had everything she needed." Kelly turns to me and says, "Eva, this is my mother, Marilyn." I brace myself, waiting for a flash of something in her eyes, a flicker of a question, knowing this is how it will always be when I meet someone new. But she smiles and wipes her hands on a towel before shaking my hand. "Nice to meet you." I'm struck by the power of belief, how easily it transfers from one person to another. Kelly believes I'm Eva, and now her mother does too, without question. I look between them, their bond as familiar as an old favorite coat. It wraps around me, making me want to sit down at the table and never leave. "Tell me what you've chosen for your project," I say to the girls. Jacinta slides her laptop so I can see two paintings side by side on the screen. Jasper John's False Start and Jean-Michel Basquiat's Boy and Dog in a Johnny Pump. "Great choices," I say. "Basquiat started on the streets of New York as a graffiti artist, commenting on the social injustices he saw and experienced. He's responsible for graffiti being the legitimate art form we know it to be today."
"I think we read something about that, but it's all kind of blending together," Jacinta says. "This is the project from hell."
"Jacinta," Marilyn warns.
"Sorry, Grandma, it's just, look how different they are. It's easy to contrast them, but how are they similar?" "They're not, at all."
I sit down in the chair next to them and lean my elbows on the table, which wobbles in the same way my mother's used to. "Here's a tip. Don't get tied up in the images. Art is all about emotion. Teachers want to know what you take away from the piece and how you apply that to your own life. It's totally subjective. So have fun with it." With the light streaming in from the windows, the rich smell of a cooking meal filling the room, and the reassuring sounds of Marilyn behind us, opening the refrigerator, moving between the sink and the stove, I feel as if I've traveled back in time, all my edges matching up with the space around me. I spend 5 more minutes filling the holes in their research. Background about each artist, their childhoods and early influences, before Kelly tells me we have to leave. "I like your family," I say as we pull out of the driveway. Kelly smiles. "Thank you. It's not always easy trying to raise a child under my mother's thumb. Because I had Jacinta so young, my mother sometimes forgets that I'm Jacinta's mother, not her. I appreciate her help, but that house is too small for the three of us." I want to tell her that the tangle of their crowded life should be a comfort, not a burden. I'd been in such a hurry to redefine myself, not knowing that I'd be carving away a piece of my heart. I assumed my family would always be there, waiting for me. Sometimes I can trick myself into believing my mother and Violet are still in our house, moving around each other, waiting for me to finally come home.
"How do you know all of that?" Kelly asks as we turn onto the on-ramp of the freeway.
I've been silent for most of the ride, my mind still back at Kelly's house, sitting at that table, feeling as if the farther we drive from it, the farther I'm traveling away from myself, who I'm supposed to be. I was an art history major in college. I don't feel I'm risking too much to tell her that, and it feels good to say something true. Kelly looks at me, impressed.
"You should be looking for jobs at museums or auction houses."
"It's complicated,"
I say, suddenly afraid if I keep talking, I'll tell her everything. Kelly laughs. Show me someone whose life isn't complicated. When I don't respond, she says, no pressure, I get it. I'm leaving a bad marriage, I finally admit. I can't afford for my husband to find me, so I have to start over again, in a field he'll never look for me. The car feels like a protective layer, safe and warm as we speed down the freeway toward Oakland. I look out the window at the people in the cars around us, so many secrets playing out in their minds. No one is going to look too closely at mine. And as far as Kelly is concerned, my story has been lived 100 times already. It takes a lot of courage to start over, she says. I don't respond. Nothing about what I've done feels brave or courageous. Kelly reaches across the center console and squeezes my hand. I'm glad you're here. Kelly wasn't kidding when she said tonight's party was a big one. There are 12 of us hired to set up and work the event, which is being held in a giant warehouse in downtown Oakland. Nearly 40 tables fill the enormous room, each one seating 8. When she introduces me to her boss, Tom, I only hold his attention for a split second before someone calls for him from the kitchen. Thanks for giving me the job, I say as he begins to hurry away. Thanks for helping out in a pinch, he calls, just before disappearing back into the kitchen. Kelly will show you what to do. Soon we're busy with linens, table settings, and flowers. I've been waiting for this event for months, Kelly says. Why? Her eyes sparkle. It's a banquet for the Oakland A's. She looks around the room. In a few hours, this place is going to be crawling with professional athletes. I'm hoping to at least get an autograph. Then she winks at me. Maybe a phone number. She slides away again, leaving me to my napkin folding, but I'm suddenly unable to make my fingers work. My gaze leaps to the exit, and then back to my pile of linens. I've run events like this before, with big names in a big location, and one of my first calls was always to the media. The more photographers, the better. I finish the napkins with trembling hands and begin the table settings, trying to remind myself that I look different now. And in my black pants and white shirt, I'll be just one of many faceless workers sliding between the crowd, paid to remain invisible. An hour into the party, I feel more relaxed. The photographers were clustered near the entrance, taking people's pictures as they arrived. There are only 2 inside, and they're easy enough to avoid. I feel my chest loosen again, and I navigate the large space, offering appetizers and napkins. Some people smile and thank me, while others take what I'm offering without even making eye contact or stopping their conversations at all. I'm surprised by how physical the work is. You're a natural, Kelly says as she passes me, carrying a tray of dirty glasses toward the kitchen. I massage a knot in my shoulder. It seems pretty simple. Keep the food moving, stay in the background. I think of Marcy, the caterer I always used in New York, a tiny woman who had the grace of Jackie Kennedy, but the countenance of a bulldog. She commanded the respect of all who worked for her and had a gift for making any event sparkle. Her staff was always impeccable, though until tonight, I had no idea how hard they worked. I wonder what Marcy thinks of my passing, whether she will cater my funeral. As I circulate among the guests offering bacon-wrapped scallops, I pass a beautiful woman in a tight blue dress, holding a whispered argument with a well-built man who must be one of the players. Just stop, Donnie, the woman hisses. Don't fucking tell me what to do. My nerves tighten reflexively, even though I know he's not speaking to me, but the way he spits the words at her, his voice laced with venom, makes me hurry past them, eyes cast downward. Fear zapping all my nerve endings and making my skin buzz. I know what it's like to be on the receiving end of that kind of anger. And I wish I could turn back, help that woman in some way. I wonder how many people here know this is how he treats her. The other players, the wives and girlfriends. Do they see it and look away, as so many people did with me? Do they whisper about it to each other but do nothing to help? I feel impotent with rage at the careless way people discard other people's problems, and how I'm no better, watching it happen and doing nothing. My eyes track them as they move away from me and become swallowed by the crowd, the way his hand remains on her lower back, and how easily that can shift from solicitous to a shove. Midway through dinner, a man approaches the microphone set up at the front of the room, and the crowd claps. I take my tray and stand alongside the back wall to listen. He has the voice of a radio announcer and talks about his years of working inside the booth at the stadium. But my attention is soon drawn back to that same couple, now directly in front of me. At first, he's trying to silence her with what looks like platitudes and promises, but she is having none of it. Her anger spirals upward, and I tense, waiting for him to react. Don't make him mad, I silently plead with her. You still have time to turn this around. My palms grow sweaty and my breath comes in short gasps that I try to elongate, reminding myself that all couples argue. Just because my husband used to hit me doesn't mean this man will hit her. And yet my body is reacting, tensing, preparing. The man at the microphone draws another laugh, which covers the sound of their argument for a moment, but when it dies down again, their words slip into the silence. Heads turn toward them. The woman begins to step away, but Donnie grabs her arm, yanking her toward him, the people nearest them gasping. I'm close enough to see the fear flash through the woman's eyes. It's just a split second, but it's long enough to tell me that this has happened before, that she knows what will come next. Without thinking, I drop my empty tray to the ground and push off the wall, taking two giant steps until I'm between them, doing what no one ever did for me. I press my palm against the man's shoulder and say, "You need to let go of her." Surprised, his grip loosens, and the woman yanks her arm away. She rubs it, staring daggers at him over my shoulder, and says, "You're a fucking liar, Donnie." More people turn away from the speech, at the sound of her voice, and stare at the three of us. "Cressida," he says, "I'm sorry, I didn't mean it. Don't follow me. Don't call me, I'm done." She pushes past me toward the entrance, and I finally step back. And that's when I see them. Three separate cell phones, pointing at us. Recording.
Eva, Berkeley, California. December, 2 months before the crash. Eva rewound the tape and listened again to Dex's voice. He refused to do what he was told. "I don't want the same to happen to you." It wasn't enough, so she began to keep a log, writing down the number of pills made and the dates she passed them over to Dex. She couldn't always risk recordings, and she didn't even know if Castro could use them. It was like trying to drive blind. She had to intuit her way toward what she'd need through instinct and guesswork. And throughout it all, she tried hard not to think about what might happen if she was discovered. Despite her efforts to remain focused, images flashed like a movie behind her closed eyes, jerking her awake at night, sweaty and panicked, certain it would never work, convinced they already knew. But she used that fear, allowing her to get even more work done, her sleepless nights growing more and more frequent as she waited to see if Castro would return. She could feel him out there, a heavy presence that lurked in the dark corners, biding his time, and she only hoped she'd be ready when he showed up again. Downstairs, someone knocked on the door. She and Liz had plans to shop for a Christmas tree at a special tree farm Liz had found online. Eva had declined, not once, but twice, citing reasons that Liz stepped around. She'd badgered until Eva capitulated, rationalizing that it was easier to accommodate Liz than to keep avoiding her. Liz would only be there for another month, and then she'd be gone, back to Princeton for spring semester. Eva tried hard to ignore the sharp stab of sadness she felt every time she imagined Liz's apartment, quiet and empty. But if it all went well, Eva would be gone shortly after that, and it would no longer matter. She hurried down the stairs, reaching for her coat as she swung the door open. But it wasn't Liz. It was Dex. "What are you doing here?" she asked. He didn't waste time with a greeting. Instead, he stepped into her house, kicking the door closed behind him, his expression hard. "What are you playing at?" Panic pulsed through her at the thought that somehow someone had figured out what she was doing.
I don't understand, she whispered. Last week's package was 100 pills short.
What?
No, that's a mistake. No shit, it's a mistake, Dex said. What the fuck, Eva? Are you trying to get yourself killed?
She shook her head, desperate to make Dex understand, desperate to get him out of her house before Liz showed up.
I'm tired, she explained. I'm not sleeping. I must have miscounted.
She couldn't explain the bone-deep exhaustion that accompanied trying to be two completely different people simultaneously.
You need to fix this.
I will.
Today, he insisted.
Next door, she could hear Liz's footsteps descend the stairs, and Eva closed her eyes momentarily.
I can't today.
Dex looked incredulous.
Do you have something more important to do?
She looked down at the coat, still gripped in her hand. My neighbor and I are shopping for a Christmas tree.
Dex looked up at the ceiling, as if he couldn't believe what she was telling him, and swiped his hand across his jaw. Jesus Christ, he said.
Then he looked at her, his gray eyes piercing through her.
Do you realize how hard I had to work to convince Fish to let me handle this? How close he came to sending someone who wouldn't ask questions or give a shit about a fucking Christmas tree?
His voice was growing louder, and Eva worried that it would travel through the wall or onto the front porch where Liz would be any minute. As if on cue, she heard Liz close her front door and lock it.
You need to go, Dex. I'll take care of it, I promise.
He looked at her, as if he were trying to see beneath the surface, to glean whether something bigger was going on.
By tomorrow, he said.
Tomorrow, she agreed. He pulled open the door and came face to face with Liz, startled, her hand raised to knock.
Hello,
she said, her gaze traveling between Dex and Eva, curious. Dex's expression shifted into an easy smile.
I hear you two are shopping for a tree. Have fun.
He gave them a wink, ever the performer playing his part, before bounding down the stairs and striding away.
Who is that? Liz asked. He's handsome.
Eva tried to gather her wits, to lighten her expression to match Dex's friendly tone. The last thing she wanted to do now was shop for a tree. But if she backed out, Liz would have 100 questions. That was Dex, she said.
Are you too?
She said, trailing off. Eva pulled her door closed and locked it.
It's complicated, she said.
Let's go. As they drove north toward Santa Rosa, Eva let the miles put distance between herself and what happened, compartmentalizing it into a tiny ball where it sat like a pebble in her shoe. She was furious with herself for being so careless, for working herself so thin she'd make a mistake like that. She couldn't risk any kind of targeted attention. And yet she'd invited it in. By the time they reached the tree farm, she'd worked out a plan. After they returned to Berkeley, she'd work all night, again. She redoubled her efforts to focus on Liz, who was describing the tree they'd buy. A special one they'd plant in front of the house instead of propping it in a stand of water for a few weeks.
You won't believe how beautiful it will be,
Liz told her as they walked between rows and rows of tall, majestic pines. She examined each tree, checking to see whether it was full all the way around before moving on to the next one. She spoke softly, carried somewhere else by memory.
My dad and I used to do this when I was a girl. Every place we lived, and there were many, the two of us would look for a new tree to join our family.
She reached her hand out as they walked, brushing the pine needles with her fingertips.
He made Christmas magical.
When Eva was little, when she thought there was still a chance they'd come back for her, she used to fantasize what Christmas would be like if she'd grown up with her birth family. If her mother hadn't been an addict, but instead the kind of parent who would insist Santa was real, staying up late assembling toys and filling stockings. And when Eva woke, she'd race to the tree and tear off wrapping paper, each present bigger and better than the last, always exactly what she wanted. Maybe her grandparents and extended family would come over. Perhaps there would be cousins, other children to round out the image of her perfect family.
But now that picture had shifted, carrying with it the knowledge that those Christmases would have been heavy with her mother's absence. "Will your daughter be coming for the holidays?" Eva asked, unsure how she'd feel about meeting Ellie, of being displaced by the daughter of Liz's heart. "She's working," she said. The finality of her tone made it clear that she didn't want to discuss it more. Liz slipped between two trees and into another row. "This one," she called, her words muted by the thick pine needles surrounding them and underfoot. Eva followed the sound of her voice and found her in front of a tree, nearly 8 feet tall and perfect in shape. "How are we going to get it home?" Eva pictured the two of them driving down the highway with this massive tree strapped to their roof, its roots dangling behind them. "They'll deliver it," Liz said, walking around the tree slowly, looking at it from all angles. "We'll string it with lights that will practically sparkle. We can bundle up, make some hot chocolate, and sit on the porch and admire it. The best part is that the tree will be here year in and year out. No more dead trees by the curb at New Year's," she said. As if Eva had ever dragged a dead Christmas tree to the curb. "What if it rains?" Liz shrugged. "Outdoor lights, glass and ceramic ornaments. I have boxes of them at home in New Jersey. But I couldn't stand the idea of a treeless Christmas, so I packed some of my favorites and brought them with me." Liz took the tag that they'd been handed upon entering and hung it on the tree, claiming it as theirs, and removed a different one that they would take with them to the front of the tree farm to pay. The afternoon was darkening into evening as they pulled out of the lot and headed south toward home. Eva leaned back in the seat and stared out the window as the warm glow of the afternoon began to fade, thinking of the long night ahead of her. Their tree was delivered 2 days later, its roots wrapped in a burlap bag. It came on an enormous truck that also carried equipment to dig a hole deep enough to plant it. Liz supervised the entire thing, choosing a spot to the left of the porch. After the tree had been planted and the workmen paid and tipped, Liz opened her front door and carried out a box labeled Christmas. With Liz's stereo blasting carols, the two of them got to work. First, they strung the white twinkle lights, and then came the ornaments. Liz had a story for nearly every one of them, gifts from colleagues and former grad students, whom she remembered with vivid detail and fondness, handmade ones from when her daughter Ellie had been a little girl. "I'm probably the only visiting professor who ever packed a box of Christmas ornaments for a 6-month post," she said. "But I've never had a single Christmas without a tree." She set aside a clumpy wreath constructed out of dough, the name Ellie written on the back, a quiet sadness on her face that Eva pretended not to notice. As they worked, Eva found herself wanting to slow things down, to draw the evening out. She thought ahead to this time next year, when everything would be resolved one way or another. She'd either be somewhere far away or dead. And Liz would be long gone, her short time in Berkeley a distant memory, Eva just another name on a holiday card list. When the last of the decorations had been hung, Liz disappeared inside and returned carrying something wrapped in tissue paper. As she handed it to Eva, she said, "I wanted to be the one to give you your first Christmas ornament. I hope that from now on, wherever you are, wherever you go, you will think of me when you look at it." Eva unwrapped the layers of tissue paper, revealing a hand-blown glass bluebird. "The bluebird is the harbinger of happiness," Liz said. "That's my Christmas wish for you." Eva ran her finger over the smooth glass. The detail on it was amazing, with deep swirling blues and purples fading into almost ice white in some places. "Liz," she whispered, "it's incredible. Thank you." She reached down and hugged Liz. Liz pulled her tight, embracing Eva in a way she'd always imagined her mother might. And she nearly broke,
So strong was her desire to be known, to be seen instead of constantly protecting herself, measuring her words and actions against discovery. It all felt like too much to carry alone. And Liz was the sort of person who might help Eva out from under it. The words rested right behind her lips, trembling, waiting to break free. But Eva swallowed them down. "I didn't get anything for you."
"Your friendship is gift enough," Liz said. "Let's turn on these lights and have a cup of hot chocolate."
They carried chairs from Liz's dining room onto the porch and sat with their feet propped up on the railing. The tree lit up the dark night, its lights glowing as if from within, cloaking everything else in shadows.
"I found out my mother is dead," Eva said, her voice just a whisper in the dark.
She couldn't give Liz the truth about her life, but she could give her this.
"She died when I was 8.
Liz turned sideways in her chair and looked at her.
"I'm so sorry," she said.
Eva shrugged, trying to steel herself from the pain she still felt at the discovery. "I'm trying to tell myself this is better, simpler. At least she had a good reason for not finding me."
"That's one way to look at it," Liz said, turning back toward the tree.
"Will you try to find your grandparents?" Eva thought about how the discovery of her mother's death had crushed her, and she wasn't sure she had it in her to be disappointed all over again.
"I don't think so," she said.
"It's easier not to know."
"It's easier until it's not," Liz said,
"which is kind of how life goes.
When you feel ready, maybe you'll look again."
With every conversation, with every confidence she shared, she was drawing Liz closer to her, to the truth of who she was. She wanted to both push Liz away and inhale her at the same time. It settled something inside of her to set some of her secrets down, to know that even after she disappeared into a new life, someone would hold the pieces of her old one and remember who she'd been. In the distance, the campanile bells chimed the hour. When they were done, Liz said,
"That man from the other day, tell me more."
Eva hesitated, so tired of lying. "It's nothing," she finally said. "He's just a friend." Liz sat with her explanation for a few moments before asking,
"Are you safe?"
Eva shot her a look. "Of course, why?" Liz shrugged.
"I thought I heard yelling, and his face for a split second."
She trailed off.
"My ex-husband used to do that. Be angry one second, then the next, it was as if a mask had slipped over his true self."
She shook her head.
"It just triggered something in me, that's all."
Eva considered telling Liz a version of the truth, that Dex was a colleague, that she'd made a mistake at work and put him in a bad position with their boss. But that was the tricky thing with half-truths. They led so quickly toward bigger revelations, like sliding down a hill, gaining momentum with every one. Liz turned in her seat again so that she was facing Eva, watching her, waiting for her to explain. "We had plans to meet for lunch," she finally said. "I forgot. He was mad, but it's fine. I'm fine." Liz waited a beat, as if weighing Eva's story, waiting for the rest of it. But Eva remained silent, and next to her, she felt Liz's curiosity and worry morph into hurt. Disappointment that Eva didn't trust her with the truth.
"I'm glad to hear it," Liz finally said.
As Eva stared at the tree, something shifted inside of her. Something shiny and vulnerable and dangerous rose close to the surface, breaking through her hard exterior. And Eva knew without a doubt that being loved by Liz was more terrifying than anything she'd ever done, because she knew she wouldn't always have her. Long after Liz had gone to bed, Eva sat there, watching the houses along the street go dark, one by one, unwilling to turn the lights on the tree off and go inside.
"Not yet,"
a tiny voice inside her whispered.
She felt invisible, as if she were the ghost of who she used to be, come to visit this life and lead herself somewhere better. From beyond the tree's illumination, Eva heard the sound of quiet footsteps. She sat up, her senses sharpening, thoughts leaping immediately to Dex, to Fish, the fact that she wouldn't even know it was him until it was too late. A man appeared on the front walk, cast in a dark shadow from the bright lights of the tree, and she squinted into the black night as he approached and made his way toward her. Agent Castro stepped into the circle of light created by the tree and leaned against the porch rail. Eva remained seated and waited. All these weeks preparing, organizing, planning. And now the moment had arrived. She glanced at Liz's dark windows and said, "How long have you been waiting?" "A long time," he said. "Years." Eva took in his face, fatigue etching shadows beneath his cheekbones, and realized they were not so different. Both of them weary from trying to maintain a facade that had grown unwieldy. In a quiet voice, he said, "What can you tell me about a man named Felix Argros?" Eva kept her eyes on the tree. "I've never heard of him." That much was true. "You might know him as Fish." She didn't answer. As long as she didn't say anything, she could stay inside this neutral space where she'd neither betray Fish or have to lie to a federal agent. He continued, "You are not my target, Eva. If you help me, I can protect you." Eva gave a short, mirthless laugh. If Fish knew Castro was here right now, Eva wouldn't see the end of the week. "You're going to have to make a choice," he said. "I thought the task force was disbanded." If Castro was surprised she knew this, he didn't let on. "Let's just say we scaled back. You've turned into quite a sports fan." Eva kept her eyes on the tree, although all her attention was on Castro, marking his posture, watching his body language. She knew he didn't have anything on her, or he would have arrested her, not crept up to her porch in the middle of the night asking questions. "I'm just a waitress who likes football and basketball," she said. "Want to know what I think?" he asked. "Not particularly." "I think you want out." His voice was soft, but his words cut through her anyways. How clearly he saw her, how much of her mind he already knew. She shot him a quick glance and he smiled, as if something had just been confirmed. "Time's running out," he said, pushing off the railing and standing upright. "I can either keep this conversation a secret or let slip to someone inside the department that we've talked. How do you think that might go over with Fish?" He shook his head slightly and said, "Even if you were to tell him about it first, he'd have doubts. And in my experience, doubts always cause problems." Eva stared at him, her options narrowing down to just one. "Why me?" she asked. Castro locked his eyes onto hers and said, "Because you're the one I want to help." He slid his card onto the railing and walked down the front path, disappearing as quietly as he'd appeared.
Claire. Saturday, February 26th. On the ride home from the A's event, Kelly and I are silent, my mind leaping forward and backwards, trying to rewrite what I've just done. I know what those people will do with the videos and photos they took. They'll show up online first, then eventually migrate to television. The question is how soon, and will anyone recognize me? I relish the quiet of the car and lean my forehead against the window, looking at the darkened apartments that back up against the freeway. As we head up the on-ramp, Kelly says, "What happened back there?" I keep my face averted, wondering what she'd say if I unloaded everything from the past few days. I imagine her eyes growing wide as I speak, the horror of what I've done to save myself edging out any friendliness that used to live there. "What do you mean?" I ask.
The way you jumped in between Donnie and his girlfriend when he lost his temper. What did you leave behind?
The road was nearly empty this late at night, and the car glides over several empty lanes, settling in the middle.
It's better if you don't know.
Kelly keeps her eyes on the road, occasional headlights from the opposite direction briefly illuminating her face before it's covered in darkness again.
Did your husband hit you?
I let the question hang in the air, wondering if I have the nerve to answer it. Finally, I whisper, many times.
And now you're worried he might see the video and find you.
I don't know how I could have been so stupid, I say. We drift off the freeway and into downtown Berkeley. The streets are empty, and in almost no time, we're approaching Eva's house. When she pulls up in front, Kelly turns to me.
Let me help, she says. I know better than anyone how secrets can fester,
cutting you off from the rest of the world. I never had any true friends in New York other than Petra because I had too much to hide, so much to conceal and protect. And now that I've escaped, nothing's changed. I have to hold Kelly at the same distance in order to protect my secrets. They're just different secrets. I offer a weak smile, wishing more than anything Kelly and I could be friends.
Thanks, I say. But it might be too late for that.
Upstairs at my computer, I type in the web address for TMZ. Right at the top is a link showing Donnie and Cressida's fight, posted just 45 minutes ago. The headline says, "Fight between baseball star Donnie Rodriguez and girlfriend turns physical." I click on it, and the video pops up. There's no sound, just the footage, but the resolution is incredible. It shows Donnie and Cressida fighting, the way he grabbed her arm and yanked her toward him, and me stepping into the middle of it all. There are already over 200 comments, and about halfway down, I see it. NY Pundit.
Hey, does anyone think that woman in the background looks a little bit like Rory Cook's dead wife?
No.
I breathe into the empty room and think about the Google alert this mention has activated to Danielle's email, to Rory himself. I quickly navigate to his inbox and open his alerts folder. The email sits at the top of a long list of unread notifications, and my first instinct to delete it. But that will only delay the inevitable. Danielle will still see the alert, read it, and click on the link. She will watch the video, perhaps several times, before taking it to Bruce. Together, they'll figure out the best way to approach Rory, to show him that the wife who was about to leave him, the one who supposedly died, is alive and